Coming up on Fronteras, in January, Ann Kirkpatrick will make a comeback in Washington representing Arizona's 1st District. She's not a by-the-book Democrat. She says she's a daughter of the district.
You know, both my mother's family and my father's family go back almost 100 years in the district. I was born in the district, raised in the district, raised my family in the district, and so that's the way I see myself.
More on Ann Kirkpatrick and how she can strengthen her foothold in Congress. And another Arizona politician with a unique background is also headed to Congress.
I'm just really proud of the Democratic caucus that we look around. I look around in our meetings and I think we really look like America.
A profile of Representative-elect Kyrsten Sinema. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among 7 public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its Local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Immigration to the U.S. has slowed in the last 3 years as a result of the economic recession. Some migrants are even choosing to go back home. In Mexico, the economy is growing, but that growth isn't happening in a sector that offers hope for returning migrants, as Mónica Ortiz Uribe reports.
The border bridge in Nuevo Laredo during the holidays is like a never-ending gypsy parade. A motley crew of travelers bunched together at the inspection area on the Mexican side. They carry truckloads of stuff, from bicycles to lawnmowers to waist-high bins brimming with clothes and shoes. Most are going back to Mexico for a long vacation, but others are headed back for good. Like Ariel Espinosa, who owned his own construction business in Florida.
The construction business started to go down, and I don't see anything to start to recover the whole business. I lost one house, cars, and properties.
In good times, Espinosa was making $40 an hour. Lately, his income has dropped to $12 an hour, not enough to pay his bills and support his family. So he's moving back to his hometown in central Mexico, the place he left 18 years ago.
It's the goal when you move to the United States. Better life, but right now, it's hard.
Mexico's economy is growing at a rate of about 4% per year, according to the International Monetary Fund. That's faster than Brazil, one of Latin America's strongest economies. But much of Mexico's growth is concentrated in trade and manufacturing, and these aren't the industries where low-skilled returning migrants are easily absorbed. That means returnees like Espinosa may face a struggle ahead. The central state of Zacatecas has one of the highest departing migration rates in Mexico. But in recent years, the tide has turned as people come back. At a school in the small town of Pastoria, a teacher gives her students a lesson in science. The school recently enrolled 43 new children whose parents have recently moved back from the United States. Magali Lopez Ruiz is the mother of 3 of those children. All are U.S. born. They moved from Virginia a year ago after her husband got deported. Readjusting to life in Mexico has been difficult. My son rebelled when we first moved back, she says. He stopped eating. In Virginia, Lopez made at least $600 a week cleaning apartments. Now she's unemployed, and her husband works in the fields making about $10 a day. Other families at the school are in similar situations, barely making ends meet. Rodolfo Zamora Garcia is an economist who specializes in immigration. He says the good news about the Mexican economy doesn't necessarily apply to returning migrants.
La migración ha sido el mecanismo de promoción.
The only form of social promotion they know, he says, is immigration. In fact, the Mexico these migrants return to looks very much like the Mexico they left. Half the population is living in poverty. Loans are hard to come by for those who want to start a business, and numerous monopolies in everything from milk to telecommunications discourage budding entrepreneurs. Until those things change, some economists say migration north will continue. Back at the school in Pastoria, children blow up balloons to play a game of darts at recess. The recently arrived American students sometimes sneak in a few words to each other in English. One of those students, Christopher Acosta, says he doesn't plan to stay here long.
We're going to go back when we're a little bit more older. Like in high school, we're going to leave.
Reporting from Zacatecas, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
This story was produced in collaboration with reporter Lillian Lopez and Round Earth Media's Mexico Reporting Project. Now to U.S. politics. She won, she lost, she won again. Anne Kirkpatrick will represent Arizona's 1st Congressional District when she returns to Washington in January after sitting out a term. As a Democrat in a conservative Western District, she has a tricky balancing act. From the Changing America Desk and Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
First elected to the House in 2008, Anne Kirkpatrick turned a red district blue. Then in 2010, the backlash against President Obama and his health care plan hurt her. So a Republican dentist from Flagstaff took her seat for a term. When the district was redrawn to include fewer conservatives, Kirkpatrick was able to build a coalition of disparate groups, seniors, copper miners, ranchers, and 12 tribes.
Yate, shik'e. Anne Kirkpatrick.
Here she is speaking Navajo in a campaign ad. Kirkpatrick is not a by-the-book Democrat. She voted for President Obama's health care reform and economic stimulus, but she also voted against a bill aimed at curbing global warming and stood with Republicans in support of an Arizona copper mine. She's more conservative than some Democrats, but she refuses to join the conservative Democratic coalitions. Kirkpatrick says she's a daughter of the district.
You know, both my mother's family and my father's family go back almost 100 years in the district. I was born in the district, raised in the district, raised my family in the district, and so that's the way I see myself.
She grew up in the endless pine forests and pristine lakes of the White Mountains, where her father taught her how to hunt. Kirkpatrick was an ardent gun rights supporter, at least until 2 years ago when she says the shooting of former Representative Gabrielle Giffords led her to rethink her views.
How could it not? I mean, you know, Gabby Giffords was a mentor of mine in the state legislature and also in Congress. And, you know, this has hit really close to home.
As the nation is currently abuzz with talk of gun control, Kirkpatrick has joined the refrain of everything is on the table. But that's not what her website says.
The lead issue is the Second Amendment.
That's Fred Solop, a political science professor at Northern Arizona University. He pulls up Kirkpatrick's website.
And if I can just read this, I pledge to oppose any attempt by the federal government to undermine the Second Amendment and infringe on our constitutional right to bear arms.
Solop says this rural district with its interest in guns is conservative. More Republicans have held on to this seat than Democrats. That means despite the heavy push for more gun control, Kirkpatrick has to respect the ideologies of the district, while at the same time looking over her shoulder at her party.
When we think about the election, it's a more ideologically driven electorate in these off-year elections, 2010, 2014. It's the liberal voters. It's the conservative voters. It isn't as many voters in the middle.
Those moderate voters do turn out for a presidential election. Solop points out in November, Kirkpatrick won with 48% of the vote because a third-party candidate drew away some voters.
She doesn't have the support of a majority of voters. She needs to be thinking about 2014 and how to build that support.
Solop says Kirkpatrick has to be visible in her sprawling district, one of the largest in the nation, all the while attempting to juggle the complex interests of her constituents. Kirkpatrick says her main focus over the next 2 years is creating jobs. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. Another Arizona politician with a unique background is also headed to Congress.
I'm just really proud of the Democratic caucus that I look around in our meetings and I think we really look like America.
A profile of Representative-elect Kyrsten Sinema. We hope you'll stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. This January, Arizona will send a very different type of congresswoman to Washington. Democrat Kyrsten Sinema is a social worker who rose quickly through the state legislature. She also grew up homeless for a time. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, Peter O'Dowd has this profile.
Sinema is also young, just 36, and on this rainy winter morning, she's holding a regular coffee meeting with voters in central Arizona's new 9th Congressional District.
Isn't it exciting?
It is.
Hello.
Hello. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The next time they'll meet, she'll officially be Congresswoman Sinema.
So I want to start today by giving you a couple updates. So we won the election, right? That was good. Yeah.
Update number two, Sinema's got a place to live in D.C. and an office. Plus, she marvels at the number of women, minorities, and members of the LGBT community that will join her in the freshman class. Sinema is the first openly bisexual member of Congress.
And so that I'm just really proud of the Democratic caucus that we look around. I look around in our meetings, and I think we really look like America.
For a while, it was unclear if the Democrat would make it this far. It took nearly a week after Election Day for Sinema to learn she'd beaten her Tea Party opponent by 10,000 votes.
You know, how often can you say a kid who is homeless is going to Congress?
Sinema grew up in a Mormon family. Though she's no longer affiliated with any religion, she says her family's conservative roots helped launch her career. Amid recession in the 1980s, her parents divorced. When the bank foreclosed on their home, Sinema moved into an abandoned gas station with her mom and stepdad. She says for 2 years, they had no toilet or electricity.
I kind of grew up with a mix of two things. One was kind of this individual work ethic that my father and my stepfather and my mother all taught me, which was never depend on anyone else to do things for you and work really hard on your own.
And Sinema did work hard. She graduated from college at 18. She got a job as a social worker, then a law degree. In 2004, she ran for the state legislature and won. This year, she threw in a PhD for good measure.
And at the same time, I benefited from the help of church and family and government my whole life.
I had no doubt she would be in Congress someday.
Democrat David Lujan was a colleague of Sinema's at the state capitol. He says she was the smartest person there and the hardest working.
There were a lot of people that were jealous of her, and I saw that on both sides of the aisle.
Early on, Sinema formed a reputation as an outspoken advocate for women's rights and same-sex marriage. But Lujan says she also learned to moderate her tone and found Republicans to co-sponsor her bills. Even critics say they respect Sinema's charm and political skill. But Republican State Senator Frank Antonori says it's a masterful ruse.
She created this transformation as going from one of the most left-wing leftists of the state house into one of the more moderate Democrats in the state Senate, which was a facade.
And perhaps shrewd. Her district is made up of almost equal parts, Republicans, Democrats, and independents. GOP political analyst Chris Mays says to win, Sinema had to seek the middle.
It is representative of a changing Arizona, such that you're going to see a much more diverse cast of characters go to Congress from Arizona than ever before.
Anyone who is willing or able to come to Washington, D.C. for our swearing-in is more than welcome.
Back at the coffee shop, Sinema wraps up her hour-long chat with supporters. It ranged from immigration reform to access to education. After they leave, I ask Sinema to consider the public's fascination with her.
I speak my mind. I'm not really afraid of things. I actually don't think that's that unusual. And I think it's not a surprise here in Arizona.
The real surprise may come later. Will Sinema continue a path of moderation, or will this new generation congresswoman end up too liberal for Arizona voters? In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Millions of undocumented migrants live a shadow existence in the United States. They can't vote for any political figures, but it may come as a surprise that south of the border, Mexico has a shadow population of its own. They are Mexicans who never got a formal birth certificate and are technically invisible in their own country. They can't get a school diploma or practice a profession. Reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe traveled to southern Mexico, where this problem is at its worst.
Octavio Martinez is easily recognized in his hometown. He lives in Santa Maria Huatulco, near the Emerald Bays of Mexico's southern Pacific coast, in the state of Oaxaca. Tourism here means work. But some of the poorest job seekers won't be hired in places like hotels and restaurants because they are undocumented. Martinez is known as the man who brings people back from oblivion.
Gracias, manito.
On a recent afternoon, he rides in a battered old minivan with no air conditioning. Martinez can't drive himself because he's paralyzed from the waist down. He gets around on a wheelchair and with help from a generous network of friends from taxi drivers to attorneys. A young woman in a torn tank top with a toddler at her side stops him from the sidewalk. She asks, "You're the one that does the civil registries, right?" Her husband needs to get his paperwork in order. She asks how much it'll cost, and they agreed to meet over the weekend. Mexico's National Registry estimates that between 7 to 9 million Mexicans are without a proper birth certificate. Here, babies aren't automatically registered at birth. Mexican parents must take their newborns to the local civil registry office. Those who don't typically live in Mexico's rural or indigenous regions or are extremely poor. Karen Mercado heads the Bee Foundation, a nonprofit based in Mexico City dedicated to eradicating this problem.
A lot of these people, they don't understand the importance of having a birth certificate until they have to get the children to school. By then, the children are five, six years old, and they have to pay fees. People who live on less than $5 a day, that they tell us, look, a birth certificate is a luxury to us.
Oaxaca has one of the highest numbers of unregistered Mexicans in the country. The state government sponsors a month-long program once a year where people of any age can register for free. But it's not enough. Martinez helps hundreds of people all year round. As a community organizer, the city gives him a stipend twice a month to compensate for his work. These are the people Octavio Martinez works with almost daily in Oaxaca. On a recent evening, Martinez visits a woman who lives 20 minutes out of town on a rugged dirt road. One of her boys is unregistered. He's 9 years old and can't get credit for school.
Como padres, nosotros sabemos.
We now know that registering your child is important, she says. Without a birth certificate, it's like they don't exist. Undocumented Mexicans are sentenced to a life with little promise. Not only are they deprived of an education and a formal job, they can't open a bank account, can't get legally married, or register their own children. Even worse, they are often targeted by organized crime, either as a victim or a recruit. The problem of underregistration isn't exclusive to rural regions. You'll find invisible citizens even in the urban jungles of Mexico City.
Aquí en este prado, yo tengo años trabajando aquí.
Like Brígida Mata Luna, she spent half her life selling dry chili and garlic off a noisy sidewalk. She thinks she's around 80 years old. She doesn't know for sure because she's never celebrated her own birthday. Only recently did a church group help her register for a birth certificate. But this late in life, the most she'll benefit from it is by getting government welfare. Also, when she dies, she won't end up nameless in a pauper's grave. I'm glad to have my paper, she says. Before, I lived like an animal. Now, I live like an actual person. For Fronteras, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
As 2012 wraps up, here's the weather forecast for the next 20 years, hotter and drier. A study released this week of weather patterns for the southwest U.S. predicts a serious reduction in rainfall, snow runoff, and water supplies. Fronteras reporter David Martin Davies has the story.
Whether you've bought into climate change or not, it doesn't matter, because it's here. It's getting worse, and it's making the Southwest an even drier place. That's according to scientists like Richard Seeger of the Columbia University Earth Institute.
These projections
projections need to be taken seriously, and changes in water management, changes in the policies regarding water need to be developed that can take into account the fact that there will be less water within the region in the future.
Seeger released a study in the journal Nature Climate Change that predicts a 10% reduction in the amount of rainfall in the region.
Which doesn't sound like too tremendously big, but given that the river flow is already all used and allocated, any reduction is bad news.
And he says Texas will get the worst of it.
Particular case of Texas, this is both because of a decline in precipitation and also because of an increase in temperature.
But Seeger isn't predicting the end of the world. He says it's bad, but it's manageable. The predictions are based on the results of computerized weather simulations using the latest assessments of climate change. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. And for headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.